Let's begin this morning at Trump Tower in Chicago. The building has been around for a number of years now, but the retail space still underused. Joining us this morning, Alex Nitkin, a reporter at The Real Deal. The story dropped yesterday online, this week online. Alex, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thanks very much.
The report yesterday I saw was really interesting, and I wanted to share it with all of our listeners because we sit here in the shadow of Trump Tower. We can see it right out our window. And the idea that there's all this retail space below it that's never been used is an interesting one. What's going on?
Right. I mean, it was a curiosity to us as well. That's why we wanted to learn more about it. It's this very central, extremely visible location. It's right on the river. It's right across the street from the Riverwalk, that city-owned land that has come up and become so crowded every summer and filling with tourists. And we're trying to find out, okay, how is it now that it has now been... It just passed the one-decade mark. The Trump Tower opened in January 2009, and to our knowledge, no part of that deck retail space has ever leased. It's never been used, and we looked into it and found that that's true, that no part of it has ever leased, and started talking to some smart people, some retail brokers who are familiar with it, and also looked up tax documents and basically found that the answer is mostly the design, the location, the way it's laid out. It's just hard to get customers there. It is below grade. You have to go down some stairs to get to it. There are some giant pillars that sort of block the site. It curves in and out, and basically just a really hard time for anyone who's trying to get, you know, cafes or restaurants or any kind of user to fill that space.
And what's interesting, too, is that apparently this design from the beginning, there were people saying this is not going to be such a design conducive to consumers. So this has been from the beginning sort of a warning sign for the Trump organization, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we were able to get on the phone. Charlie Reese, who was a executive at Trump Organization, who was overseeing the design process, who was, you know, involved in real estate, who basically said, yeah, I mean, we knew that it was going to be a challenge. And what he said was that the city mandated that with its, through its approval process, said the city was very involved and said, you know, there needed to be some kind of publicly accessible space going along the river. And I mean, that's backed up by the actual plan development document that's still online that we found. The city was very involved and clearly had a real interest in making sure that that space was open and there was something there. But as far as we can tell, there was nothing from the city that mandated that it was two separate levels with low ceilings. There was nothing from the city that mandated these very big columns that seem to block sight. And so it's tricky to understand exactly how much of the design was avoidable, but yeah, they seem to have acknowledged that it was, you know, going to be difficult from the beginning. I don't think anyone realized, though, that it would go 10 whole years just being this completely empty shell.
Yeah, and the developer Carr in your story actually is quoted as saying it's a dreadful space. That's a pretty bad indictment of the space, isn't it?
Yeah, she is a retail broker from SVN Commercial and has been pretty much observing this from the very beginning. And she was really not alone in saying that. You know, we quoted a number of brokers who, you know, have been doing this a long time and understand what it takes to lease a space and just pointed out a lot of things that maybe to the layperson wouldn't really notice. The fact that if you have to go downstairs to get to a place, it just makes it that much harder to have customers get to. But the interesting thing, I have to say that of all of the brokers who were talking about it, no one was quite as down on the space as the Trump Organization's own tax attorneys were in the tax appeal documents that they submitted to the assessor and then the Board of Review, trying to get a lower tax assessment. This was done year after year, and the most recent one we obtained, and it just says over and over the layout cannot effectively or economically be utilized by most retail tenants. They're just saying, basically, look, the design is so poor, basically, the design is so limiting that, you know, how can you expect us lease anything basically here, and using that as justification for, you know, we should pay lower taxes on this. The Trump organization should have a lower tax assessment, and they have gotten lower tax assessments on that basis.
Yeah, and conspiracy theorist in me has to ask: was it designed because of that to get a tax break or not?
You know, it's easy to wonder that. We definitely wondered that along the way, and we did actually manage to get somewhat of an answer on that. And for last year, at least, it looks like attorneys at least claimed that, you know, estimating a pretty low rentable potential, you know, rent, low rentable value, that they could have gotten something like $1.7 million in revenue from rent last year if they had rented it out. And ultimately, they shaved about $500,000 off their tax bill from a lower assessment. So at least last year, it seems to us that, you know, that calculation would not have been worth it. It's possible that was an intention of theirs, but it's also hard to believe that the Trump organization would want to have such an incredibly visible, you know, sign of failure at the same time. That it's hard to believe that that is a bargain that they would want to make, particularly since it looks like, at least, you know, the last couple of years, it has not been paying off.
Alex, before the break, we were talking about the unused space, retail space, that's really never reached any potential at all. I'm interested to know how this is impacting that neighborhood around Trump Tower without retail. How would it be different if it were a bustling retail center?
Well, you know, it's tough to say. We spoke to one developer who, his name is Mark Goodman, who's sort of quoted toward the end of the piece, who owns another retail property around the corner from there, and there's sort of a plaza behind Trump Tower and 405 North Wabash, the tower just north of there, and was talking about how, you know, it would be great if that could get leased up and sort of create a sort of continuous retail district. But I think that apart from him and maybe a couple other retailers, I think the nature of the space and how separated it is, not a lot of landowners, you know, developers, shop owners seem to really know or care that the space is empty. You know, we also spoke to Alan Lev, who's the principal of a development group called Belgravia. I don't know if you walk down on Wabash next to Trump Tower there, there's a new condo building that just went up. It's just being finished now, called Rennell on the River. And we called them up and asked, hey, are you concerned about this, that you have this condo tower that's gone up, you know, right next to Trump Tower, and the residents in these condos will be, you know, a stone's throw from this big empty space. Are they going to miss that? Are they going to wonder if anything is going to go there? Is it, you know, are you concerned about it? And he basically said, no. No one really even knows that it's there. It's because it's so out of the way, because you can't really see it. Sort of playing into the same reason why it's never been leased, why they've had so much trouble finding tenants there. Essentially because it's just, you know, unless you're on the other side of the river, on the Riverwalk, or, you know, you're on the Wabash Bridge, you just can't really see the space and don't really notice it.
Did Trump's branding problems these days have anything to do with this? Would it be any different had there not been the dings on his brands and his popularity?
You know, that's really hard to say. It's an easy assumption to make. I mean, you hear, you know, the residential condo brokers talk about how there's kind of a discount on the condo prices in the tower because of the brand. It's, you know, easy to think that that could apply to the retail part as well. And, you know, one of the amazing pieces of information we got in this tax appeal, they went through, and the attorneys, tax attorneys representing the Trump organization, went through each individual tenant that they spoke to and gave a reason why they passed. It was dozens of potential users for that space, and a lot of them just said, you know, not interested in Trump Tower, looking, you know, trying to find somewhere else. So it's always been underlying, you know, understanding or assumption. It would be understandable, and the Trump brand could have a kind of stigma in a city where the guy got 13% of the vote in the 2016 election. But, you know, it's hard to say exactly how much that really factors into it.
Alex, we have about 30 seconds left. I want to ask real quickly, is there any way to change this? Is there any redesign that might happen? Is there any rehab or reconstruction that might be able to fix some of these problems?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not really sure, honestly. It's possible that maybe the facade could be changed or it could be set back. I'm really not a construction expert, so I couldn't begin to imagine exactly how many changes could be made. I mean, it's really hard to believe that those gigantic columns could be taken out of there. I mean, since they seem to be carrying the load of a 98-story tower, mm-hmm. And you got to believe that it's a lot harder to do a renovation in a space like that at the base of such a huge structure. So I suppose it's possible, but it's just hard to imagine what that would look like.
Alex, this is a great story. Thanks for sharing it with us this morning and getting up and being on the opening bell with us.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
Alex Nitkin, a reporter at The Real Deal. TheRealDeal.com is where you can find the story. We'll link out to it as well in the podcast of The Opening Bell.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
We're back on our Thursday edition of The Opening Bell. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Our next guest has overseen a $300 million transformation of Navy Pier, Chicago's top tourist attraction, which drew more than 9 million visitors in 2016 into 2017. Marilyn Gardner is the CEO of and president of Navy Pier, and we're happy to have her on this morning with us. Marilyn, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Congratulations on all of the success at Navy Pier, first of all.
Well, thank you, but as you may know, it's just really beginning.
Yeah, it is, and we want to talk a little bit about that this morning, but I want to set the stage, just set the table a little bit for our listeners. Talk to us about this transformation, what's been going on at Navy Pier, and why you say it's just the beginning.
Well, Steve, we began our redevelopment officially in 2014 with construction and renovation of the public realm, which we call Pierscape. We also reinvigorated the food offerings. Our new food experience is much more reflective of the diversity of Chicago. And we embarked on a plan that we think was bold, but infused new life and really took advantage of the unique space that Chicago fills in the city, and went back to the pier's roots as the people's pier. And the transformation has been about bringing the pier to life as a space that's truly reflective of Chicago.
And so we would see if we were there, if anybody visited recently, it feels more open. Of course, the Ferris wheel, if you just drive by it, you can tell it's been refurbished. But is it that you're trying to do, is sort of open it up and have more of an historic feel to it?
That, and also take advantage of the unique space. You know, the pier has such a unique vantage point where, you know, the phenomenal vistas of the lakefront, the city skyline, all of those spaces come together at Navy Pier, and there's really no space that has that opportunity to showcase those views, open them up, make them accessible. But then not only that, not only the physical redevelopment, but the bringing those spaces to life with programs that are reflective of what's truly best in Chicago. And when I talk about programs, I don't only mean, you know, the cultural experiences, but also the dining, the retail that happens at the pier. And now you'll see that those experiences are reflective of the city. We actually went into the neighborhoods and found dining and retail experiences that can only be found in Chicago.
The on-site business that happens at Navy Pier every day is pretty stunning, and I don't think most people have any sense of it, but 70 on-site businesses, 5 nonprofits, 3,000 people work on Navy Pier every day. That's a big impact. That's a lot of work happening there.
Right. So that 3,000, that's the number collectively employed among those 70 businesses that operate on a daily basis at Navy Pier. So really it is, you know, a city in itself or a neighborhood in itself, and the pier has become, you know, not only a great civic space but a resource for the community and a space where, you know, great commerce happens on a daily basis.
Well, this is Women's History Month, and the transformation at Navy Pier has opened up quite a few new and interesting opportunities for women-owned business especially. Talk to us a little bit about the drive you're making in that area.
Well, we've made a very concerted effort to ensure that, again, that the businesses are reflective of Chicago's great diversity. And of those 70 businesses that we were talking about, 26% are minority-owned and 37% are women-owned businesses. And that's been important in our transformation. You know, we have a responsibility to Chicagoans. We're stewarding the People's Pier into its second century, and it was important to us to ensure that we're creating opportunity for locals, and that it's a place that locals can be proud of and embrace.
The numbers, I'm guessing you would want them to be a little bit better. Are you actively still recruiting more women-owned businesses, more minority-owned businesses as well for Navy Pier?
Absolutely. As we move forward, we'll continue to make that a priority. Fortunately, we're fully leased at this juncture, but as we explore opportunities, also with contractors throughout the pier, that continues to be important. We have goals of 26 and 6, and we continue to exceed those, and that's not good enough. We have plenty of room for improvement and continue to strive to do better and better and make opportunities available.
The gauging of success, I'm guessing, is difficult. Is it at the end of the year the economic impact number that you look at? Is it the number of smiling faces that have passed through Navy Pier? How do you gauge success for the pier?
Like you said, it's difficult, but there are several factors. Obviously, the attendance numbers, as well as the revenues, the profit margins in particular, but, you know, it is those smiling faces. It's the shift in perception that we've been driving in recent years that, you know, is really the most rewarding of everything, and that Chicagoans are rediscovering Navy Pier, learning and figuring out that there's a new Navy Pier. This isn't the Navy Pier we grew up with. This is a pier that's much more reflective of our great city, and it, you know, is truly the People's Pier. It's a resource for our community, and as people are discovering that and embracing the pier as their own, that's where we gauge our success. It's the shift in perception, the excitement, enthusiasm, not only for the beautiful, more open, bolder, more contemporary spaces along the pier, but the dynamic programming that's reflective also of the city that people are embracing and coming back to enjoy again and again. That's success.
There are a couple of reports out that have been circulating that the public has a chance to see now. One is an economic impact study by the University of Illinois Regional Economic Applications Laboratory, and there's also a Navy Peer Impact Report. Any surprises from either of those reports?
I think what the public would be most surprised about is the number of partners that have joined us in making this transition possible. As a mission-driven nonprofit, we have engaged hundreds of philanthropic and corporate partners who have taken ownership in helping advance the vision and mission of the pier. And when I said earlier that it's really just begun, that's one of the things I was talking about. We have more work to do. We have grand plans for continuing to transform the Crystal Garden, Pier Park, the Far East End Plaza of the pier, again, to ensure that the pier continues to be the people's pier. And it's been exciting and truly rewarding to see so many coming on board to help support the mission and vision moving forward. And again, lots of work to come, lots of exciting things on the horizon, and we're thrilled with the response and the enthusiasm and support that we've received to date, and we know we'll continue to thrive in that area.
Well, Marilyn, all the best to you and everyone at Navy Pier, and we'll be watching with excitement to see Navy Pier move forward.
Well, thank you, Steve. We look forward to welcoming all in the coming months.
All right, Marilyn Gardner, President and CEO of Navy Pier.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures in the red this morning now. Fractionally, though, Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures all off just a fraction as we head to the opening bell. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. At the Mercantile Exchange yesterday, live cattle futures dropped for a fourth straight session, pressured by weaker cash cattle prices and seasonally rising supplies. One analyst said we're going to be coming into more market-ready cattle numbers in May, and those numbers will just get bigger over the summer to levels well above last year. And as of April 1st, we will have the largest number of cattle on feed ever in the history of the industry. Taking a look at the grain market at the Chicago Board of Trade yesterday, soybeans dropped to a four-month low on hefty supplies. The market hitting concern about the slow pace of U.S.-China trade talks. And, of course, those talks are set to resume today and continue into tomorrow in Beijing. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, outlook for Thursday, March 28th, the final GDP growth report for the fourth quarter of 2018 leads off the reports. Analysts see the nation's economic growth slowing to 2.4%, down from 3.4% in the third quarter. Also today, a weekly look at first-time claims for unemployment benefits. Analysts forecast 225,000 Americans filed initial jobless claims last week, 4,000 more than the week before. Pending home sales for February come out today as well. Housing industry experts predict an increase of 0.7% last month, down from January's 4.6% surge. Also a report on farm prices today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, March the 28th.